From CJSR FM 88.5, my name is Matt Herjee, and this is the CJSR Edition. Acclaimed Canadian author Lawrence Hill knows a lot about blood. As the author of this year's Massey Lecture, Hill has dived in to the Ruby River. In his book, Blood, The Stuff of Life, Hill investigates how blood can mean different things to different people, and how its meaning has changed over time. Today, blood is a double-edged sword. It both haunts and heals us. In the end, though, there is no substitute for it.
Maybe it's the color. Maybe it's because blood doesn't look like anything else in nature, almost. Like, when do you see something and mistake it for blood and you're wrong? It happens very rarely. Usually when you see blood, you know it.
It's the CJSR Edition.
This is the CJSR Edition, broadcasting from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, on 88.5 FM and CJSR.com.
On this week's show, we proudly present The Blood is Thicker Than Water Show. Two long-form interviews about the substances that sustain us. It's blood and water on the CJSR Edition. First up, Lawrence Hill talks about the liquid that singularly unites us and divides us. Blood. How it acts as a marker of inclusion and exclusion. How it's so vital to our sense of ourselves. How it's used to understand physical prowess and illness at the same time. Then later in the program, water. We speak with the foremost Canadian expert on the matter, Maude Barlow, National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians and tireless advocate for water sustainability. Her newest book, released earlier this year, is called Blue Future. It's the CJSR Edition. Stay with us. This is the CJSR Edition. My guest today is acclaimed Canadian writer Lawrence Hill. Hill is the author of 9 books of fiction, as well as nonfiction, including the award-winning 2007 novel, The Book of Negroes. His newest book, Blood, The Stuff of Life, was published in 2013 and serves as the basis of this year's CBC Massey Lectures. Blood, The Stuff of Life, offers a critical examination of the socio-political significance of blood. It details how our perceptions of the red substance have changed over time, how blood brings us together and pulls us apart, how it pulses through religion, literature, and the visual arts, how it's a marker of identity, belonging, gender, race, class, citizenship, athletic superiority, and nationhood. Hill's book takes the substance that is so integral to our very humanness that we almost take it for granted and places it under a microscope, examining it from every possible historical and contemporary angle until blood is elevated to its rightful place in the reader's mind.
Yeah, it's cool to sort of take something that we almost take for granted, something as basic as our blood, and then stop and think about it and kind of really get into it.
I reached Lawrence Hill from a CBC studio in Toronto.
So are you all ready to go for the Massey Lectures and stuff?
Yeah, Yes, I am. And
we're also ready to go for the interview now, too.
Okay, well, that's perfect. I want to just start then perhaps with a simple question, but perhaps it may yield a more sophisticated answer. After reading this book, Mr. Hill, what is blood?
Well, blood is a fluid, about 6 liters of which flows in our veins. It contains all sorts of different cells and nutrients and waste products. It circulates like a river through our bodies to keep us alive. It's a fluid that we can take from ourselves and give to other people. Quite rare for the human body just to be able to take something from oneself even regularly and give it away and not be damaged and do it again a little later and again and again. So blood, of course, is a liquid that keeps us alive, a sacred fluid. But it's also a representation of all the ways that we understand ourselves.
Interesting. Could you elaborate on that idea of blood being able, blood being a liquid that allows us to understand ourselves?
Well, for thousands of years, we humans sort of coasted in the West, certainly in Western civilizations, on the theory that the body was made up of four humors, one of which was blood. And blood had to be kept in balance with the other humors. And if you were ill or diseased or injured, perhaps you needed to have some blood let out in order to reestablish the correct balance between your humors. And it's hard to imagine sometimes, but this way of thinking of blood being one of the four humors needing to be in balance with the others and needing to be let out of the body when there was too much of it for one's own good health, this dominated our sense of ourselves physically for thousands of years. And for thousands of years, we practiced bloodletting actively in the West. But with this notion of blood needing to be let out of the body when there's too much, and blood sort of affecting and being tied up with one's personality, if you have a lot of blood or the right sort of amount, perhaps you might be a sanguine person. The very word comes from blood, sanguine. With this idea that blood is central to our personality comes all sorts of social ideology about representations of blood. People assume that if you're a certain race, well, that race is quote-unquote in your blood. Perhaps they assume that you might be inferior if you're a woman because of the way you bleed monthly. There are so many ways that blood in our imaginations feeds into the ways we treat each other and see ourselves, and that's what interests me the most.
You write in the book that blood is just about the hardest stain to get out of our clothes because the hemoglobin in blood acts as a binder when it hits air and binds with the fibers of your clothes. But I think it's also possible to use this analogy when we talk about how blood has this singular ability to implant itself on our imagination. Why do you think it has that ability?
Well, that's such an interesting question, and you're so right. I mean, just think of Lady Macbeth. I mean, even though she might have been able to get away with her crime, she can't because she's got blood on her hands in her mind, and she knows that she's got blood on her hands. And even though literally it's probably been washed off and you can't see it anymore, she's consumed with the idea that there's blood on her hands and she can't get it off. That whole out damn spot thing really harkens to the notion of the unremovability of the evidence. Maybe it's the color. Maybe it's because blood doesn't look like anything else in nature, almost. Like, when do you see something and mistake it for blood and you're wrong? It happens very rarely. Usually when you see blood, you know it. You know there's trouble, and you rarely see blood and don't think it's blood, or see something else and mistakenly attribute it to blood, unless it's fake blood. So it's singular in the way it looks. It's connected to our psyches, and we feel it sacred. I mean, we have this relation to the blood in our bodies. It's unlike any other. Like, are we all worked up about our saliva or our urine? No, we barely give those things a second thought unless we have some particular problem. We don't think about other fluids or substances. Do we get fixated on our kidneys or our livers or our toes? Not really, unless, again, there's a specific problem and you have a kidney or a liver disease or something. You're not normally going to be thinking about those organs very much at all. They don't sort of feed into your sense of self. But blood, absolutely. In blood you encounter your own blood. You encounter, unless you lead an incredibly protected life, you'll certainly spill your blood a few times in your life. Of course, women spill it monthly, and so they should. If they're not spilling it, They're not healthy if they're of childbearing age, unless they're bearing children in that 9-month period. They need to be spilling their blood monthly to stay alive. So we have all these encounters with our blood that we don't have with other parts of our body. So I think we truly do think of it as something magical. And finally, we have this complex relationship with blood. On one hand, it can save us. On the other hand, it can kill us. So blood can unite us, it can divide us, it can save us, it can kill us, literally and figuratively. And so we give it great importance in our bodies, but also in our psyches.
It's visceral, is it not? Blood, when we see it?
It sure is. It has a smell, too.
Now, near the beginning of the book, you highlight this personal anecdote about your relationship with your own blood, and it's that schoolyard accident where you cut your hand, and then you had this urge to mark the earth with your own blood to sort of... I really like that description, to prove that you were alive, almost. Yeah. Why did that event imprint itself on you so concretely?
Well, for your listeners that don't know, in a nutshell, what happened was that I was a young boy. I was maybe 7 or 8. I don't remember exactly, but I was quite young. And I was playing on all fours, hide and seek on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, cut myself on the schoolyard, put my wrist down on a broken beer bottle, obviously not seeing it, put it down, cut myself quite deeply. So I was bleeding heavily, way more than you should be bleeding. And so I was quite frightened. So I ran home, and all the way home, 200 meters uphill on a sidewalk, I made sure that my blood spattered out onto every panel of the sidewalk. I wanted to mark every single panel of that sidewalk between the point of accident and my mother's and father's house, which was 200 yards up the street. And I guess you could just laugh and say that that was a very immature and silly boyish thing to do, which it was. But I think I'm interested in it because of my mind. Like, what possesses an 8-year-old boy who's terrified and maybe in a little bit of shock to slow down enough to do that even in his terror? Clearly, to me, this fluid that was pouring out of me was sacred, and I didn't want to waste it. I wanted to use it to mark my presence in the sidewalk, almost like etching your initials into wet cement. You know, that's very attractive to an 8-year-old. Well, this is even better. Spilling your blood on the sidewalk, is that ever a way of marking your territory and perhaps laying down your immortality for all to behold?
So even at a very young age, you sort of had a sense of the importance of blood.
Honestly, if you talk to any healthy 8-year-old, they'll have a sense of importance too. You know, if any healthy 8-year-old is going to know, if it's going to be very worked up if there's a lot of blood spilling from their body, they know that's not a good thing, and they'll be quite concerned about it, and they know that it's wrong. We know at a very young age that stuff's supposed to be kept inside. It's not supposed to be pouring out.
I think the big question that often comes up throughout the book is whether or not this fascination with blood, this human fascination with blood, is like biologically rooted in humans, or whether or not it's societally created.
I think it's both. I mean, I don't know. I think that we're wired to know that if we're spilling lots of blood, there's something wrong, and we need to. Animals know that too, you know. Well, for one thing, if animals detect your blood spilling, and that animal happens to be a shark or maybe a grizzly in the woods, well, you're going to smell even more tasty, and you'll be that much more attractive as bait. So animals come after you. Dogs and bears, they know about your blood and the smell of it, you know. Sometimes even women, you know, who are hiking, I love to hike. And if you're hiking in an area that's infested with bears, say in Banff or something, sometimes there are warnings, you know, be careful if you're menstruating, if you're a woman, that, you know, you might be in danger. And so there are all sorts of ways in which animals respond to blood. And, I just don't think we can ever quite shake it.
Near the beginning of the book, you say that you've had a lifelong obsession with blood. I'm curious how your relationship with this particular substance has morphed through the writing of a book like Blood, The Stuff of Life.
I don't know that my relationship with blood morphed or changed in the course of the writing. I think what happened is that I was given a year to really ponder and think about all the different ways that I relate to it. Let's be honest. I mean, in a normal day, in a normal year, I'm not spending all of my day wondering about my blood. I am more connected to it and fixated on it than most people for all sorts of personal reasons, which I can talk about if you want. But I think what happened is that the book gave me, and the writing, the lectures, gave me the chance to meditate on all the different ways that I am connected to my blood, and again, that other people, I think, are connected to theirs.
Well, you alluded to it then. Let's talk about that. You have a unique perspective on blood for a number of different reasons. Your familial relationships with blood, your diabetes, the link to your ancestry. What stands out to you the most?
Well, I mean, whether it's diabetes or whether it's being a recreational athlete still and having been a serious but very ineffective competitive runner when I was younger, whether it's race, you know, whether it's injecting insulin daily and monitoring my own blood sugars several times a day so I need to know what my blood is doing, you know, at key moments in the day, especially before and after exercise or before and after eating, that kind of thing. So I'm checking it. I have to. That's considered good management of a disease. So I do have a reason to be aware of it on a regular basis. I would say that the first notion of blood that I had was blood as a physical substance that was frightening to be spilling out of my body. So the first notion of it was the physical blood that was coming out of my body in accidents when it shouldn't have been when I was a young boy. But quite soon, following on the heels of that, is the notion of blood as a representation of race, and the idea that growing up myself in Toronto in a mixed race family, black father, white mother, I came to be drawn early in life into notions of myself and notions of race, and an early awareness that race and blood in our minds are very closely tied together. Whether we like them to be or not, other people will tie them together for us, and will constantly speculate about your blood. Say, oh, I see, you're half and half, as if truly your blood can be divided into racial parts, which is an absurdity, but we think that way anyway.
I guess that leads me to my next question then. I think one of the primary theses of this book is that our perceptions of blood oftentimes don't align with the reality of what it actually is. I'm wondering, in your opinion, what accounts for these disconnects?
Well, I think what's happened, I don't know, that's a huge question, and I'll just do my best here. I think we have sort of taken literally the ideas of blood and we've bought the metaphors as if they're factually based, when indeed they're just metaphors, they're just ideas. So we've come to truly imagine that blood and race can be equated, and that you can quantify race in the blood, even though such a thing is a complete absurdity. So we have the Supreme Court of Canada in 2003 weighing in on whether or not a Métis father and son are sufficiently Métis to be hunting without a license, because one is supposedly only has 1/64th Métis blood, and the other, the son, supposedly has only 1/128th Métis blood, according to arguments that have been made by others in court. And so we have, you know, our institutions, parliaments and courts, ruling on racial identity based on blood quantum, or being asked to do so. And so we have taken this idea that is imaginary, and we've begun over time to treat it as something that was real. And for anybody who thinks that this is just a theoretical meditation with no practical applications in life, all you have to do is start thinking about genocidal murders over the course of time, including the Rwandan genocide or the Holocaust or the Cambodian genocide or the Spanish Inquisition. Each time, it seems, we start murdering each other genocidally as humans, we call into play the impurity of the blood of our victims, and we justify our heinous acts by describing our victims' blood as impure. Over and over we do this. What does that mean, impure?
Right.
We'd buy it over and over again. We sell it. Perpetrators of genocide use this to sort of defend their actions. And so I would argue that it's not just a theoretical passive observation on my part, but that it plays out in real life over and over again and continues to today.
Why do we buy it as humans? Why do we buy into that idea?
Maybe sometimes some parts of us, some evil parts of us in some parts of the world here and there need to hate, and blood is easy to latch onto because of its strong metaphoric value. I suppose if we didn't have blood, you know, we're still going to go on hating from time to time. We might latch onto something else. I don't know what. But we do have blood, so that's, I don't know what to say. It's easy, you know, it's easy over and over again. Think of women and witches and the way to demonize a witch and to burn her at the stake. Think of all the thousands of women who've been killed because they were allegedly witches sucking the blood of innocent people and so forth. We burn a witch at the stake because maybe she's bloodless or her blood is impure. Even witches were gone after. Women, you know, who are said to be witches, were gone after because of their so-called blood impurities.
Hmm. I have two more questions. I understand that we're sort of running out of time here, but a large portion of your book is dedicated to how our notions of blood have evolved over the years. You describe it as a symbol and a substance that divides us and reveals us and unites us.
One of the most interesting things about it is what it reveals about our generosity. I mean, when you think about it, normally if you want to donate, you want to give, you want to help another person, you'll be paid for it, or you'll be recognized, or you'll get a tax break, or at least the person you're giving to will get down on their knees and thank you. If you give, say, $1 million to a museum or something, and you get the museum to name part of it after you. But when you give blood, first of all, normally you're not paid, unless it's plasma, and even there you're not paid much. Nobody knows who gave it. You don't know who you gave it to. Many people will get pieces of your blood because your blood will be broken down and, you know, distributed in parts. And so it's a very selfless, you know, truly philanthropic way to give. And you're giving something, there's a bit of pain and discomfort involved, and it's coming out of your own body. So it brings out the best of us. And when, you know, when times are tough and somebody does something awful, like blow up the Twin Towers in New York or bomb the marathoners in Boston, people rush to blood donation centers. They want to give to express their humanity. So that's something beautiful about blood.
My final question, and I think it relates to the entire conversation that we've had today. Blood has this ability to pervade our psyche, and it lends itself as a route to how we reconcile sort of our humanness, and it has this ability to create distinction and therefore conflict, but it also has this ability to bring people together. So how can we use blood to move beyond this paradigm of distinction into a paradigm of oneness?
I think that the thing to do is to use all the best ways that we think about blood that unite us. You know, if you're moved by the suffering of others to give your blood, or if you feel a beautiful connection in your family and you imagine that that's blood-based and it spurs you to have greater sense of self or identity or good feelings about the world because you feel confident in yourself, that's great. Those are all ways that we can draw upon blood for strength, to give to others or to just live well. But if blood is sucking us into negative behavior, or if we're allowing our governments and our courts or our genocidal perpetrators to use blood to justify unjust actions, to say the least, then of course we need to try to shake those instincts off and move to a more noble way of living. So I guess we have to use our judgment about blood. Use it when it's good and cast it off when it's bad.
Lawrence, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Lawrence Hill's newest book, Blood, The Stuff of Life, was published by Anansi Press in August 2013. It will serve as the foundation for this year's CBC Massey Lecture Series, which I should note here is making a stop in Edmonton today, October 25th, 2013, at the University of Alberta's Meyer Horowitz Theatre. The lecture, entitled From Humans to Cockroaches, Blood in the Veins of Power and Spectacle, begins at 8 p.m. Lawrence Hill also has a free event at the University of Alberta at noon today. You can find more information about these talks, as well as more information about Lawrence Hill's writing, on cjsrnews.com. This is the CJSR edition, and we'll be back after this very short break.
To the CJSR edition on 88.5 FM in Edmonton and around the world on cjsrnews.com.
Welcome back to the CJSR edition. Up to 60% of the human body is comprised of water. The brain is composed of 70% water, and the lungs, nearly 90%. About 83% of our blood is water.
Okay, my name is Maude Barlow, and I'm the National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians, which is a national nonpartisan, nonprofit environmental and social justice movement in Canada.
Well, Maude Barlow says that water is the blood of the earth. And noting the significance of water, Barlow has tirelessly advocated for water sustainability for over 10 years. She has fought to change people's perception around H2O. Urging them to think about water as a right and not a commodity. In 2009, she served as senior advisor on water to the 63rd President of the United Nations General Assembly and was a leader in the campaign to have water recognized as a human right by the United Nations. She is also the author of many reports and several books focused on water sustainability. On October 10th, 2013, Maude Barlow arrived at the University of Alberta to speak about her newest book, Blue Future, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. I had the opportunity to speak with Barlow about the current realities of water sustainability prior to her lecture.
Well, we're in deep trouble as a planet. It depends on where you live, and it's still very hard in Canada to get people to understand the crisis globally. A colleague calls it the reality of modern water, and that is that in the West and in the, you know, in the more urban areas, more certainly in a neoliberal capitalist world, we see water as being a resource for our pleasure, profit, and convenience, and we don't see it as the essential element of a living ecosystem. We just have completely divorced ourselves. And water has become a resource for a certain kind of society, a certain kind of industrial development, a certain kind of economic development. So we dump whatever we want in it, and we move it anywhere we want, and we pave over if it suits us. And we, we think we're going to look after one part of an issue like air pollution, you know, by shale gas fracking or biofuels, because who cares about water? So we have this myth of abundance and this notion that water is here to serve us. We see water as a legal entity, that we own water, it's property. And this kind of thinking has led us to displace, pollute, and mismanage the world's water to the point where we really literally are a planet running out of water. And I document that very clearly at the beginning of the book. Demand for water is going straight up and the supply is going straight down, even though we all learned back in grade six that wasn't possible. In fact, it is indeed possible, and it is indeed happening right now.
You said it. It's difficult as Canadians to see holistically how dire a crisis is. How can we as Canadians sort of wrap our head around it?
Well, we better stop thinking that we have all the water in the world, for one thing. I mean, it was only a couple of years ago that Environment Canada removed from its website that we had 20% of the world's water. And everybody kept saying to them, that's wrong. Yes, okay, technically, if you dry up every drop, every lake, every aquifer, every river, yes, we do. But if you look at using the water that we can access without ruining the base, we have about 6.5% of the world's fresh water. And we are polluting it. We are over-extracting it. We are careless with it. Here in Alberta, particularly, there are many things that are being done. I mean, I consider Alberta probably to be the first water have-not province. It's the one that's most in distress, although there are other areas of distress. There's Lake Winnipeg. There are the Great Lakes. There are many issues across the country. But this is a place where water is just with a abandoned being used for more and more exports, which of course is exporting the water out of the watersheds. You don't have to put a pipeline in to export water away. So, I hope that it's not going to take, you know, a set of emergencies in Canada for Canadians to realize what we're up against. I fear that it may. Part of the reason for the work that we do at the council, the work that I do, the book, this book that I've written and others, is to try to get people thinking about it, have it taught in schools and so on, so that we're not going to start caring about it only when, you know, the Bow River isn't running anymore because the glaciers are gone. And everybody said, oh yeah, I think I remember reading that that was a glacier fed river. Well, you know, we've got to get our heads around this, because even if we manage to hold on to our water, and we do in fact have more water per capita than most countries, in a world running out of water with water refugees, we're going to have to answer to this water and to other people who have a need of it.
Is there a singular greatest threat to Canada's water?
There are two major issues that I see around water in Canada that are the greatest threats. One is the cuts to freshwater protection that has happened under the Harper government. He has gutted the Fisheries Act, the Navigable Waters Protection Act, the Environmental Assessment Act. 99% of our lakes and rivers now are absolutely unprotected from any pipeline carrying the dirtiest crude on earth going under, over, or around them. I mean, Lac Megantic was delisted, for example, from protection.
Even on top of that, I'm just thinking the research facilities,
absolutely
the Experimental Lakes Area.
Experimental Lakes Area, one science center after another, the war on science. They've shut down the major center that was looking after the Great Lakes. I mean, it's as if any talk of water protection is anathema to this government, because they so want to promote and protect the extractive industries, and they wanted to remove every single barrier to these extractive industries having whatever access they wanted. So I really deeply worry, and I say this with not one bit of hesitation, that the only real law that we have left is our First Nations treaties. And so when I say the First Nations are leading the way, this isn't semantics. This isn't something nice to say. This is true. They still have some governance rights and resource rights over these waters that have been lost. We've lost the rules and the tools. And now, of course, the Harper government is moving to extend trade agreements like the Canada-European Trade Agreement, CETA, which basically would give big corporations from Europe the right to claim water the way corporations from under NAFTA from the United States are able to claim water and so on. So, I mean, they're really moving to constrain the not only the controls and regulations and protections for water, but to do it in a permanent way so no future government can ever undo it. So I think this is a very dangerous trend. The second trend I see in Canada that I think is very dangerous is galloping privatization. And it might not feel galloping to people, but I've watched this in other countries where it starts small. What most people don't know is that about three budgets ago, the Harper government was the new reality that any municipality wanting to upgrade infrastructure for water or build new infrastructure, because maybe they've grown a lot, can only access federal funds if they go to a public-private partnership. And I remember saying at the time, this is going to lead to municipalities being forced into privatization, even if they don't want it. And the irony is that all over the world, where they've tried privatization of municipal services, they're moving back. I mean, In France, 40 municipalities, including Paris, have re-municipalized because it was such a mistake. But only Canada, 10 years later, after the rest of the world, is being forced into these decisions. So you've got places like St. John, New Brunswick, that are having this debate, a very fierce debate. We lost a referendum in Regina, Saskatchewan last week because the Harper government said there's, I think it's $650 million. And the city council said, yes, thank you very much. And then they turned around and spent several hundred thousand dollars advertising to people in Regina. And we just couldn't, you know, match that kind of money. Different decision in Abbotsford, British Columbia, where they rejected it and rejected the council that tried to stuff it down their throats. But it really is going to gallop across the country as municipalities realize that if they don't have the money themselves, they only have one way to go, and that's privatization. And then again, if you think about this comprehensive economic and trade agreement with Europe and the two biggest water companies in the world, Veolia and Suez from France, have a toehold, then a future government in Regina wouldn't be able to undo it. So it's kind of a box. I'd also warn around the whole issue of water trading, which Alberta's looking at, and we believe British Columbia is going to start looking at. And this is where you convert licenses to basically property rights, water property rights, and you start allowing the trading and selling. I think they're going very slowly here because I think there's a huge backlash against it in Alberta. They can read the polls as well as anybody, but I do think the intention is to start to move towards privatization.
Is there a country that you can point to that is being a particularly good steward of water that maybe we should be looking to as an example?
I wouldn't say a country. I've got lots of examples in Blue Future about communities and different projects that are happening. For instance, in Germany, northern Germany, they have a law that no food production systems or any other kind of industry that exists on the waterways coming out of the Alps can hurt the water in any way that renders it unfit for drinking water, and it has to be clean enough coming out of the tap for babies. That's actually the terminology they use. Very, very strict. Actually, Europe's gone to watershed-wide management, which is where they know that most of their watersheds cross two or three or four or even five countries, because these countries are little compared to Canada. And rather than saying, well, that's my share, what they're saying is we're going to govern them on a watershed basis. And so that there's been some very exciting work that's been done there. Ecuador has adopted a constitutional amendment to protect the rights of water and the rights of nature, which they actually, you know, have formulated now that water has fundamental rights, and they've set up a process where citizens can take action and so on. We have a number of countries in South America that have come together in a different kind of trade bloc that, yes, they want to trade, and they're not against, you know, trade and prosperity and so on, but they use the term, we don't want to live better, we just want to live well. And built into their trade agreements are protections of water and nature generally. So there are examples, and there are many examples around the world of communities engaged in rainwater harvesting, sort of some of the old techniques that were lost, again, when this sort of modern water concept was imperial water, it was sort of imposed on the global south. So there are many examples that I give in the book of where people are and communities are doing things in a different way. But it's one of the problems is that I don't know why it is that federal politicians in most countries in the world, with some exceptions, just don't see the problem. Maybe they, you know, in grade six, that lesson we all learned that you can't run out of water, and we all have this hydrologic cycle, like there's a big river out there and you can stick your straw in it, it'll never run out. I think that got ingrained in everybody's minds, and people just can't get their heads around the fact that it's not so. I mean, in the U.S., they're having one, you know, election after another, presidential elections, and they argue about everything except water. Well, we know that 36 states are in some form of water crisis as we speak. We know that the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the water, the aquifer that runs down the spine of Western United States and is their breadbasket, will be, and I quote, gone in our lifetime. That's the Department of Agriculture says. I mean, how can you have an election and not talk about it? In fact, I just read something today where the state of Texas is saying that the drought they're going through now is worse than the Dust Bowl drought. I mean, it's worse, and it's probably more permanent. So how this, you know, this disconnect between the reality that and this is all over the world, the reality of what we're dealing with and the plans to plow ahead. You know, I have this image of government working, and so here's the food and agribusiness part of government promoting agribusiness and promoting chemical use and more water use and so on. And then you've got the trade department over here producing, you know, policy for more stuff and more trade, which is going to use more water and so on and so forth. The energy people, I mean, energy, conventional energy uses tremendous amount of water. We think of it as greenhouse gas, but it uses tremendous amount of water. And then there's the little few people stuck over here who are saying, wait a minute, excuse us, we don't have the water for all this. But it's it's as if nobody, as if the people who are watching the water crisis and monitoring and the scientists who can tell you where the water is and where and how it's declining are somehow off in a little box, and they have nothing to do with the policy that's being created. And that I don't understand, that disconnect, when we have the World Bank even, and certainly the United Nations, coming out with very strong statements about the water crisis and the fact that by 2030, demand in our world will outstrip supply by about 40%. Really stunning, stunning statistics.
What would a national water policy look like in Canada if you had it your way? And would a national energy policy even change anything? If we're talking about these large, immobile institutions with that little voice over in the corner of a few people.
Oh, if the government meant it. I mean, if they meant it, of course we could do something. Look what Harper's, when he means it and takes away all the protections for water, he does it when he, you know, whatever he wants in terms of when he wants to spy on the Brazilians on behalf of Canadian mining companies, he does it. If they had the intention to do it, we could do it.
What would it most
affect? A good national water policy would set very strong standards, what I call based on a water ethic, which is that we have to put water in the center of everything we do. And so all our policy, trade, energy, food, economic, all of it has to ask the question, what is the impact on water? And that has to be central to the creation of these policies. And if the answer is it hurts water, then it has to be changed or dropped. And we cannot, it would look totally different. Trade would look totally different if we had to take water into account. Or if we had to ask that shirt that comes from that country and has X amount of water in it to produce, what's the water situation like that there? I mean, what would trade look like if we had to ask the question about the water footprint of this thing that you're importing or exporting? We would have national drinking water standards. We would have national very strict rules around pollution. Martin Luther King said, legislation may not change the heart, but it will restrain the heartless, which is one of my favorite quotes of his. We would have a very strong cooperative system between the provinces and the federal government to promote and protect shared water sources. We would consider water to be a public trust that belongs to the people and the future and belongs to ecosystems and other species, and we would not see water as a private resource. We would not allow water to be privatized, put on the open market like oil and gas. We would take water out of all trade agreements. We would remove water from being part of the market system whatsoever. We could set the policy for the whole world. We have the smarts. We have the water. We have a situation where we can still catch what's happening to our water, but it would have to depend very deeply on a commitment that I don't believe the current government will ever have. So I think the question now is to ask the opposition parties where their stand is on this and what they would do and what would they undo, the cuts to these regulations or not. And I would like to hear them say, yes, I will undo those.
Well, that sort of touches on the fact that, no pun intended, that water permeates every part of our society. I'm curious what your thoughts on about the best framing mechanism to understand water is.
Well, I see water as a public trust. It is it's a public service as well. It belongs to the earth. It belongs to the future. It belongs to all species. It's something that must be here forever. We're using up the future's water. We're using up the water of future generations. We're sucking up groundwater around the world at an absolutely alarming rate and way faster than it can be replenished by nature. So we are stealing water from the next generation. We need to be really, really clear, real clear about that. So to me, water has its own rights. I see water as being kind of, sounds corny, but it has having sacred rights. And we need to be protecting it with legislation and laws that are more compatible to the natural world than the ones currently. I mean, right now, water is considered property. And for instance, again, I go back to Harper. If you're going to go before the National Energy Board on any of these pipeline issues, you have to prove you have some kind of commercial interest or they're not wanting to hear from you, right? So we tend to see water and nature generally as just, you know, for us, for our convenience and profit and so on. And I think we have to see it just completely differently. We have to say that gives us life, and we have to do everything we can to protect, conserve, and restore it.
Your first book in the Blue series was Blue Gold, The Battle Against Corporate Theft, and it was published in 2002. What has changed in the world of water in the last 11 years?
There are some good things. There's much more awareness. I know I talk about politicians not being aware, but I think there's much more general awareness. There are many, many more pieces of research. There are many universities and high schools teaching it. There are many, many, many books. There are many films. There's a consciousness growing around it that was not there when I wrote Blue Gold in 2002. So that's the good. And there's also been a huge network. We call ourselves water warriors that have come together here in Canada and around the world to protect local water sources and to stop privatization. Very positive is that the United Nations recognized the human right to water and sanitation, which I was deeply involved in. I thought it would be years before it happened, but just a confluence of things came together, which I describe in the book because it's really exciting. And so the recognition that water, that no one should be doing without water because they can't pay for it, has been formally recognized by us, and I consider that kind of like an evolutionary step forward. On the negative, and I'd say on the positive, I'll stay positive for a minute, that I think we're winning the privatization war around municipal services. I think there's a lot of evidence to show that even the big companies are pulling out, and the government of France has had to rescue Veolia and Suez and put money into shares. So you've got the government bolstering these corporations because they're just not welcome in so many places. On the negative side, I am really worried about the displacement of indigenous people, communities, villages, peasants, and so on around the world for modern water projects. In India, for free trade zones, you know, millions of people being displaced. In China, they're building, they want the rural communities gone. They're pulling people into cities. They have these ghost cities. They've built these cities so fast and so big that they're great big cities that don't have any people in them. And they're just displacing people. The land grabs. There's a land grab, which is also always a water grab, in Africa now, this three times the size of Great Britain. And this is where private corporations or wealthy countries come in, and they actually buy up the land and the water for profit or to feed their people. And they're displacing the very people who know how to live with drought, who know how to live with cyclical climates, who know how to dry land farm. And what they're doing is they're pulling up, again, aquifer water, and they're building these big chemical-based industrial farms, just the opposite of what we need. So that at a human rights level, it's appalling, but also at an ecological level, it's just the wrong direction to be going. So that, if I would say the thing I'm most concerned about is that I think that when, and I predicted this in both Blue Gold and Blue Covenant, that there would come a time that where governments were making decisions around dwindling water resources to put it to economic development and growth or for people's livelihoods and people's lives. And I'm afraid we're already seeing that's happened.
In your newest book, which is the final in the trilogy, as the title would suggest, you look to the future of water sustainability. And I guess the philosophical leaps that we'll have to take in order to get to a place where water is again sustainable, what will it take for us to make those philosophical leaps in thinking about water?
Well, people are just going to have to come to grips with the fact that, you know, just like those comet movies in Hollywood, where there's a comet coming at the Earth and all of a sudden nothing really matters because the Earth's going to blow up in 72 hours. We have a comet coming at us. It's called the global water crisis, and it's not here yet in Canada in a visible way, although I would argue it is here in Alberta, and it's certainly here in other parts of the country. But it is here in the world. I mean, China, since 1990, half the rivers in China are gone. Gone. I'm not saying polluted. They were polluted. They're gone. So we need to get our heads around what this means in a world that's going to continue to grow in terms of population till it peaks around 9 or 10 billion. What does this mean? Where are people? How are people going to live? Who's going to be sacrificed in this world? So I guess what I'm hoping people can do is that we can build the kind of movement around this that we built around climate, where people really understand that it's life and death. And this is a climate issue. This is very much, I mean, the way we abuse and displace water is one of the causes of climate crisis. And restoring watersheds is one of the solutions. But I can't make people care. You know, a lot of people just, it's like, you know, when I turn the tap on and the water doesn't come out of my tap, then I'll be upset. But until then, you know, some technology will fix it. The government's looking after it. Somebody's looking after it. And this is the problem with a lot of issues that we're dealing with, is that it's, you know, just a lot of people don't want to know. It's, a friend of mine calls it the right not to know. And I think that's a brilliant term.
The United Nations established that water would be a human right. But I think that is one of the philosophical leaps that we as a society need to take, yeah, to really, really ingrain that in our collective psyche.
And some places are. I mean, since the United Nations recognized the human rights to water and sanitation, a number of countries have adopted changed their constitution to recognize the human rights to water and have set out a plan, which every country is supposed to do, by the way. Of course, Harbor government's not doing, but they're supposed to. So there is real movement taking place. And in the book, I talk about the countries and communities that are really moving this forward. Also, our movement is writing up plans in many different countries. And if their governments aren't moving, they're presenting them to the government, saying, you need to do this. Here's what has to happen in our country to fulfill the human right to water and sanitation. Here's the obligations for us here in Canada. It's really on First Nations communities, because that's really where with some areas of rural Canada not having proper water as well, but it's mostly on First Nations communities. And so that's where the attention has to go here. Other places, it's much more widespread. It's peri-urban slums and so on. You know, people said, oh, okay, the human right to water and sanitation, you're saying everything will be better the next day. Well, of course not, especially if we're also running out of water at the same time we're trying to do this. But you know, is it a step forward? Is it a statement of principle and belief that we have collectively in the world? And then what do we do? How do we start to make that real?
Well, talk me through the final point that you make in Blue Future, is that we need to make human laws compatible with nature's laws. Talk me through that argument.
Well, basically, all in Western society, water is a property, and the way the law is interpreted is that it's a property right. And so, for instance, BP in the Gulf of Mexico, the only people who could sue for compensation were people who could prove that their livelihood had been damaged. Now, you know, forget the fact that the entire ecosystem has been damaged. Nobody can sue for that, and the Gulf can't sue for that. So the concept around the rights of water is that the rights of nature, or earth rights, there are different terms for it, is that we recognize that water and nature exist outside of their service to us. Yes, it's a big step to see water as a public trust, and then it belongs to all, you know, it is equally all of ours. But then you have to say it really doesn't belong to us. It really belongs to itself. It serves its own reality. We need to leave water in the ground. We need to leave water where nature put it, because it's serving in an incredibly important function where it is. And that is all the ecosystem, all the species that depend on it, the, you know, future ecosystems, future generations depend on keeping those systems as intact as possible. And so it's recognizing that our laws of take and convert everything to a commodity, and seeing a river and seeing, instead of seeing a flowing river that's all that it's doing for our health and for the environment and keeping us all alive, we see hydroelectricity. So it's turning your head around and asking the question, what is water, and how can we serve this thing that gives us life? How can we protect it, and could we do that more compatibly in law? And that would start with some very practical things, like not allowing the privatization, not allowing, as I say, taking it out of trade agreements so that you do not allow it to become marketized, because it's very hard to take back once it's been set up as a market commodity.
I imagine that would be quite hard to do, though, to take water out of the law, because it's so deeply entrenched in, as you said, sort of how we even think about capitalism in general.
Well, I've used to be much more sophisticated, if you will, when I would speak in the Western states, California, the states that are just Colorado that are in such crisis now. And I'd say, I know your laws are complicated, and there was always the first in time, first in right, and you know, so you've got all these legal problems, and now I'm not like that anymore. You know what I say? You've got those laws were meant for a time when you thought there was unlimited water and there were only a few settlers here and you wanted to populate the prairies. For God's sake, that time is gone. You've got to wipe out those laws and start again. And they should do what Vermont has done and name their water, surface and groundwater, to be a public trust. And very clearly say it belongs to the people, it belongs to the ecosystem, they're even going to give priority in times of shortage to local sustainable food production over food production for export. I mean, they're very, very clear that this water must be protected as a public trust for all time. As I say, I used to be sort of more understanding of all the complications. I don't think it's like that anymore. I think we don't have time. We need some very, very clear principles. Water is a human right. Water is a public trust. Water has rights and must be protected. Water can teach us how to live together. Water can become nature's gift to us to teach us how to live differently, to not be a source of conflict, but rather a source of finding ways to deal with other problems, because we have this big one. You know, maybe my father hated your father because whatever, but we're all going to not be able to live on this water system if we don't fix it together. And I've got examples where communities have come together across great divides to protect the local water. Self-preservation, but preservation of my neighbor has to be the thinking. And so I, you know, in the end, I'm actually quite hopeful. I consider water to be a moral imperative, or hope to be a moral imperative, and water can be a tool to help us get there.
I have one more question, and it relates to self-preservation, because I think when it comes to water today, one of the major things that negatively impacts water management is that little actions compounded sort of have larger consequences because water is so connected. But then it works the other way. Small actions by people in aggregate can have a tremendously positive impact. So I guess my question is, what can I do in my own life to make a difference to water sustainability in the future?
Well, consciousness, just seeing water, remembering that water doesn't just come out of a tap. I think one of the biggest first problems was taps, you know. So we're just separated from this body of water that you had to use to go to and get and pull over and heat up and touch. And, you know, now we have all these taps in our homes, and so we just think it comes from somewhere else. So just, you know, establish a relationship to water and think about it. Don't buy bottled water. You don't need it. I mean, I know there are parts of the world that don't have clean public water, but that's not true here. But then I'd say take it a step further and get involved in the politics of water. Come join the Council of Canadians chapters or join, you know, other or some environmental groups or whatever. Get involved in being a water watcher. You know, if your municipality is looking at privatization, jump in and get involved. Get involved in the debate here in Alberta around water future and the water plans that the draft water plans the government's putting together. Don't be benign. Don't sit back. It's really important that we be part of something. And then make the connection between water and these trade and investment agreements, because, I mean, Alberta is producing 66% of the country's irrigated products, commodities that require irrigation, with only 2% of the water. Alberta's the last province in Canada that should be agreeing to more beef exports to Europe, and it's driving this thing, is more beef exports. More beef exports are going to use more of your local water. You know, it's a bad future scenario. We need to conserve, and people need to put these issues together. And I just think that becoming water conscious just changes your life in some really fabulous ways. And it opens a door to understand more complicated issues around the economy and trade and so on.
Mark Barlow, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
If you don't mind, can I just get 30 seconds of ambient sound from this room? Is that okay? That's all the time we have left on this The Blood is Thicker Than Water episode of the CJSR edition. This week, the program was produced by Speaking Into Microphones and by me, Matt Hergy. We produce the show in the studios of CJSR FM 88.5. Community Radio in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Thank you very much today to Lawrence Hill and Maud Barlow. Barlow's newest book, the third and final in her Blue series focused on water sustainability, is called Blue Future, and it's available now. Lawrence Hill's newest book, Blood, The Stuff of Life, is also available now. The CJSR Edition is a spoken word project of CJSR FM 88.5. For more information on this series, you can always visit our website at cjsrnews.com/edition. For CJSR, broadcasting on 88.5 FM in Edmonton, my name is Matt Hergy. Thanks for tuning in.